Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be around the world. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host this evening, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Dave Schrader. Thank you for being a part of this with us. We are right up against Halloween, so I've brought the creepy. We are going to be talking about extreme hauntings, paranormal survivors. That's the topic tonight on the show. We will be joined by three survivors of three of the most famous real-life haunted tales. Survivors from the Amityville Horror, from the actual Conjuring case, and from the haunting in Connecticut. Later on in the show, we'll actually open up phone lines and allow you to call in with questions and your own encounters with the paranormal to have these experts weigh in on their thoughts with these experiences and give you advice on how to deal with some of the more malevolent and frightening experiences you may be dealing with. So we'll do that a little bit later on in the show as we gear up towards Halloween. I want to thank George Norrie for allowing me to sit in tonight as we are getting closer to Halloween. I am Dave Schrader from Darkness Radio, and every year we do a very special program called the Halloween for Hunger campaign, where we raise money for Second Harvest Heartland, which is an amazing food shelf that works for people right here in the United States, right in your neighborhoods and backyards. What we do every year is our Halloween for Hunger campaign. You can go to darknessradio.com. You'll see the banner there. Just click it. You can go in and make a donation in any size that you're comfortable with. And let me tell you, for those of you that may not have a lot to give and would like to be a part of something, $1 donation supplies 3 square meals for one person. So $1, something that you've got just sitting in the couch or in the ashtray of your car, will feed one person for a day, 3 square meals. That's why I said any size donation will do. Our goal for this year is $10,000. We're already sitting at $7,000, and we're still a few days away from Halloween. So we would appreciate your help and kindness to give to Second Harvest Heartland, and you could do it by going to darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com. You'll see the banner. Click the banner, make your donation, and help us help our neighbors in need right here in the United States. And if you can't do that, you can email me, dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com, and I will shoot over the link to you and information so you know how to make that donation and be a part of it with us. So I just want to thank everybody that's already donated last night, and for those of you listening that'll join in and be a part of the show this evening by donating as well. When we come back, Amityville, The Conjuring, haunting in Connecticut, that's on tap. Three of the survivors are with us this evening as we discuss these cases and take your calls, your questions, your experiences, and we're going to do that right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. As we head into the holiday Halloween season, I wanted to bring the creepy and the real-life ghost tales, survivors from three of the most famous haunting stories in American history. We're going to be talking with survivors from the Amityville Horror, the haunting in Connecticut, and the actual Conjuring case. We'll be doing that in a few moments. Doing the work I do on the radio show for Coast to Coast AM and my own show, Darkness Radio, I love doing the research. I love digging deep and finding stories and things that can tie us into the history of these locations that we look into and investigate. A good friend of mine who does quite a bit of extensive research found an article, a very short blurb, I should say, from a newspaper that predates the Amityville Horror case by almost 100 years exactly. An article that, you know, in context, doesn't seem like much for the time period, but when you realize the description of this property that I'm about to read to you and the location of it, and then the story that happened almost 100 years later, you start to get a new perspective and a new feel for the way some of these stories might develop. It's so easy for us to be armchair quarterbacks and sit back and poo-poo the idea that hauntings are real or that these people experienced what they made these claims to be. But that's when you start pulling back the layers and start finding the real history behind this and realizing that something has always been amiss in these locations. That's where it gets really exciting for me. Let's take a quick look. This is from a newspaper back in 1887, I believe. Almost 100 years prior to the Amityville Horror case. And it was just a little blurb on the side of a page, almost a throwaway, if you will. And there's other little bits in there about, oh, this is going on in town, that's going on in town. But there's one small section, just a paragraph and a half is all. But this is what it says. There's a haunted house Amityville possesses a haunted house. No one knows why it is so called, but it is known as such, and that settles it. It's a place of valuable property situated on the banks of a pretty lake half a mile from the beach. It was bought some years ago by a New York party who fitted it up handsomely and prepared it for occupancy in every way, but never occupied it, and has ever since let it go to ruin. Its vast garden is full of wild weeds. Its portico has become rickety. Its Grecian columns are tumbling down, and its general appearance is weird and forsaken. The description of this property and this house sounds vaguely familiar. Well, if you've been alive in the last 50 years and are interested in the paranormal, you'll recognize Amityville as probably one of the most famous haunted locations on the planet. In December of 1975, George and Kathy Lutz and their three children moved into the house. After 28 days, the Lutzes left the house, claiming to have been terrorized by paranormal phenomena while living there. 28 days they lived in this house and left with all of their belongings behind them. Joining us this evening, one of the youngest surviving members of the Lutz family at the time, Christopher Lutz. Christopher Quarantino is here with us this evening, visiting with us again. Christopher, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Why do you think, after all these years, there's still such an interest in the story, good and bad, of what happened to you and your family? Why is there such an overall interest still going on about this?
Well, aside from its outrageous claims that would make you have sleepless nights, I believe there's a real thing behind all this. And as we dig deeper in it, hopefully these folks will understand it the way I do.
Do you think, Chris, that had the DeFeo family not died in the manner they did, and for people that don't know, on November 13th, 1974, Ronald DeFeo Jr. shot and killed six members of his family at 112 Ocean Avenue in a large Dutch colonial house situated in a suburban neighborhood in Amityville on the south shore of Long Island, New York. He was convicted of second-degree murder in November of 1975. A month later is when the Lutz family took over this house. If Butch DeFeo, Ronald DeFeo Jr., had not committed those murders, do you think as much attention would have been played out to the haunting that you and your family had experienced in that house? If you had just bought a house out of the blue and that kind of experience took place, do you think it would have been as impactful?
No, I don't. And I think that the fact that people knew about the murders, I mean, that was a tragic, seriously tragic thing to have four kids murdered in their beds, the mother and the father killed. There was nothing of that precedent at that time on Long Island. So that was pretty bad in itself.
Right, so you've got almost this kind of perfect storm that came along. But, I mean, your claims that the family, the Lutz family, had while living in this home, none of it really tied to the DeFeo murders. It wasn't as though you were seeing the DeFeo children or mother or father stalking the house and terrorizing you and your family. It really had nothing to do with them other than it was taking place in the same house where the murder occurred. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Nothing that I witnessed in there would I relate specifically to the DeFeos.
Did your mother or stepfather, George, did they ever say, you know, we think we saw one of the children, or we think we saw the mother and father? Did that ever play in as a part of the story?
No, I don't think that they had said that it was specifically the mother, the father. There was my younger sister, Melissa, had an imaginary friend that had, according to her, the ability to change its form. She had said that she played with a little boy. It had the ability to change into anything that it wanted to for her. And that is what's known in the book as Jody. And I don't know how many of your listeners, as a child themselves, had imaginary friend. And then the question themselves, was that just imaginary? Or were you interacting with something?
But even your sister never claimed to really see anybody associated with the house, right? It was this imaginary friend that could take different shapes and forms, and that was about the extent of it, though. The reason I bring
correct.
That up is
no,
that
nobody said anything that it was specifically the defense. That's correct.
Because I do think that's an important part of it, and I know that you and I have spoken off air about the fact that, you know, that was... You know, I mean, your family has been played out in movie form and TV form and book form over and over and over, and they continue to hash out new movies. And when Ryan Reynolds' new version of the Amityville Horror came out, one of the things that really got under both of our skins was the fact that they involved the DeFeo family beyond just telling the story of the brutal murder there. But suddenly the spirits of the children became a part of the story, and they were part of the reason this torture and torment was taking place for the Lutz family. And it's
you're
important.
Not kidding, the way that in 2005 right. that they made that movie and displayed the young daughter calling her Jody with a hole in her head, having the babysitter stick her finger in it.
Yeah.
How disgusting.
Yeah, it's
that was
horrifying.
These were real children that got murdered in that house. This isn't something where you just take their memory and disgrace it the way they did.
Right, and that's what I thought is important for listeners to realize as well. Because, you know, a lot of people, you know, my generation grew up watching the original Amityville Horror case and reading the Jay Anson book and the follow-ups and kind of having the story told that way. And that was, you know, that was disturbing enough. But then to have had the remake, the reimagining of it, and then utilizing both the DeFeo and the Lutz family in the way that they did was very weird. And I understand Hollywood's going to do what it does, but sometimes, you know, you have to be careful. And that's why I wanted to make sure that we were very clear that the DeFeo family had really nothing to do with the actual haunting that took place in Amityville. Let's introduce another one of our guests real quickly. The Snedeker family in 1986 rented an old house in Southington, Connecticut. Alan and Carmen Snedeker moved in with their daughter and three young sons. And while exploring their new home, Carmen found strange items in the basement, tools that were used by morticians. And soon the family discovered, to their horror, that their home had once been a funeral parlor. And the eldest son began seeing ghosts and having terrifying visions and paranormal activity that began affecting the entire family. You may recognize this from the famous movie a few years back, The Haunting in Connecticut. Joining us this evening, Carmen Snedeker. Carmen Reed is here with us this evening to share insights about her story. And on the whole, Carmen, to look at what you and your family had to go through as well. And I know you're familiar with Chris and the Amityville Horror case and with Andrea and the Conjuring case. When you hear these stories played out and then you see the way that they're portrayed in the media, portrayed in Hollywood hype, do you feel an immediate affinity to these other people because of what they had to go through that had nothing to do with the paranormal, but the way that they were perceived because of the way they were portrayed?
I surely do. I'm telling you, some of the things that the media comes up with, even in my own case, I mean, the way they portrayed what happened in my house, it's almost laughable. I mean, this is real stuff. It's very true to life stuff. And to turn it into a joke or entertainment is appalling. And I am partly responsible for that. I went public with my story. And while I was still in that house, it became like a circus because the media was already involved and they were coming to the house, knocking on the door, wanting to come in. And it became like a circus. And that's just the way, I don't know if it's human nature or if it's just the wanting to be entertained by stuff. But these are real people with real feelings and real fears and seeking help. There's so many people that don't ever come forward truly because they don't want to be made into a circus as I was and as Chris's family absolutely were and Andrea as well. We all were like the wolf man or the three.
Right, you were like you became like a circus freak show. Karen
yeah.
Smurl was on our show last night from the Smurl family haunting as well. And her family was put under scrutiny and unbelievable, unbelievable pressure because of the claims that were being made. You're dealing with something that's already got enough pressure to it. You're seeking help outside of what you would normally do. And so many people, you know, our immediate reaction again is to say, get the hell out of the house. Just move. You know, the Lutzes did. Why didn't anybody else just get out when the going gets bad? And the reality is that sometimes it's just not that easy. Life is not that easy that you could just pick up, especially when you've sunk every penny you had into getting into these locations. And maybe you don't have friends or family close by that will take on the burden of you and your family until you can find something new. That has to be insanely infuriating.
Listen to this. In my case, there was family close by. But even if I went to work, things would happen at my job. You became afraid to involve anyone else because they were going to get hurt. They were going, it was going to spread like wildfire. If it got the tentacles in another home of a family member, then you're just spreading the activity. You're not containing the activity. So what we decided to do was to go ahead and fight it. But now you got to remember, my son had cancer. The bills from the doctors came in handfuls every day. I was working two jobs. My husband was working all he could work, and there was just no way we could just walk out.
Right, that wasn't something that was afforded to you at the time. You had to deal with what you were dealing with. Plus, it's not like the landlord's going to say, oh, yeah, it's haunted. All right, you can go on out and move out. You've got leases to break. You've got big major changes to make. Now, in the case of the Lutz family with Amityville, Carmen, they were the next family to move in, and they were riding that wave of darkness that had already permeated their home. Prior to you living in that house in Connecticut, were there other families that had been there? And
no, it went from a funeral home to my apartment.
So you're kind of in the same situation. It went from being one thing to suddenly you're the first people to truly live there and be a part of it since its you know, incarnation before that.
Right. And there's another portion that I kind of don't talk about. There was an apartment upstairs, and it was not occupied half the time. But many of the people that lived in that had experiences. And they told me about it later on after I went public.
Did it frustrate you that it took them a while to come forward with that and not be so forthcoming?
No, it did not, because I understood, because if I could have gone back, I would have never gone public myself. And I'm sure Chris feels the same way. If he had the control over whether or not his story went public, he wouldn't have done it either, would you, Chris?
Oh, no way, now that I know what I know now. But at 8 years old, I had no control.
You had no control at 8 years old. I was the mom, so I had complete control. And I just did not understand the ramifications of me going public. I had no idea what was going to happen.
Right, and like with the Smurl family, in the case we spoke about last night on Coast to Coast, you know, they reached out to the media because they weren't getting the help that they needed from the Catholic Church. They weren't getting help in any way to deal with what they were dealing. So they did it in a sense as a way to try to shame the church into making somebody step up and take ownership of this and help them. So it was a desperate plea and a cry for help for them. And you know, again, they regretted it.
Same thing. We were recommended to do the same thing. That's why we did go public. We were told that it would get the Warrens told us that it would get the Catholic Church to move quicker.
Oh, really? So the Warrens were behind that idea to get get you to go to the media and talk about this case?
Oh, absolutely. They initiated it.
And that opens up an intriguing can of worms that we'll discuss a little later, because one thing that people may not know, each case, the Smurl case, the Amityville case, haunting in Connecticut, and the Conjuring, the common thread is Ed and Lorraine Warren have a tie to each one of these cases. I want to talk about that a little bit later on in the show and your true perceptions in that and what their real involvement was in the case. We're up against a break here, so I can't get into it too deeply right now. When we come back, we'll introduce our third guest from The Conjuring. You remember this hit movie that came out about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and I think still probably one of the truly most horrifying, scary haunted house movies to come out in the last 20, 30 years. beautifully done, beautifully acted, and creepy as all get out. And we're going to talk to Andrea Perrin, who survived that case, was a part of it. We'll hear some of the fact and fiction from her, differentiating between what really happened and what was portrayed in the movies and in the media. So we'll do that when we return. Stay tuned. We've got so much on tap for you. Halloween's around the corner, and we've brought the scary. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for joining me this evening. Halloween's right around the corner. Are you tired of being alone for the holidays? Wish you had somebody special to go out with and enjoy the festive parties? Well, George Norrie has the answer for you. ParanormalDate.com. ParanormalDate.com. All the people that listen to Coast AM that have signed up, this is your group. This is the people you want to meet. They have the same likes and interests as you. The strange, the supernatural, conspiracies, and more. And it's great. You can go check it out for yourself. Sign up. It's free to sign up. And then if you decide you want to become a full-fledged member, there's a great membership detail on there as well. So go check it out. ParanormalDate.com. Your connection is waiting to be made. They are now almost 54,000 members strong in ParanormalDate.com. That's a great opportunity to meet your best friend or the love of your life. So check out ParanormalDate.com. And remember, if you like what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, you're going to love what you see on Beyond Belief. That's George Norrie's TV show. Did you even know he had a TV show? Well, if you didn't, you got to check it out. It's high-speed streaming. You can check it out at BeyondBelief.com. BeyondBelief.com. All that information is conveniently placed on the CoastToCoastAM.com website. So check it out there and become a Coast Insider while you're visiting. Coast Insiders get access to over 5 years of past archives. You get access to live chats with George Norrie, the other hosts, and some of the most fascinating guests in the world. You get great news, exclusive content, and more. And how much does it cost? Well, breaks down to 15 cents a day for a one-year subscription. 15 cents a day. Give it a try, and you'll find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. Check it out. Be a part of the Insiders Club, because I promise you, once you sign up, you're never going to want to leave. I'm Dave Schrader. I'm your host this evening, and we are exploring the strange and supernatural world. Our guests this evening are extreme haunting survivors. We've already spoken with Christopher Lutz from the Amityville Horror case, Carmen Snedeker from the Haunting in Connecticut case, and now joining us is Andrea Perrin. Roger and Carolyn Perrin purchased the home of their dreams and eventual nightmares in December of 1970, the Arnold Estate, located just beyond the village of Harrisville, Rhode Island. It seemed like the idyllic setting in which to raise a family. The couple unwittingly moved their five young daughters into the ancient, mysterious farmhouse where secrets were kept and then revealed within a space shared by mortal and immortal alike. Time suddenly became irrelevant, fractured by spirits making their presence known, then dispersing into the ether. The house is a portal to the past and a passage to the future. You saw the movie The Conjuring, and if you didn't, check it out, especially with the holiday season of Halloween around us. If you're looking for a good spooker, this is one of the best horror movies I've seen in a long time. But let's talk now to a real survivor of that case. Andrea Perrin is here with us this evening on Coast to Coast as well. Andrea, welcome back to Coast.
Hi. Oh, it's great to be with you tonight, dear. I'm coming to you from the beautiful Black Swan Inn, a very haunted house in San Antonio, Texas. And the festivities are winding down here. I'm secluded away in the back part of the house so that I've got you all to myself and you've got me all to yourself. But I do have a spirit here in the room with me who likes to open and close the door at will. I've gotten quite used to her, so we're good to go for the evening.
Excellent. So if we suddenly hear blood-curdling screams and doors slamming, we shouldn't be alarmed. You're just used to that.
Yeah, you wouldn't hear any blood-curdling screams from me, although there are still some ghosts, guests, not ghosts, on the property right now. So, you know, there are all bets are off, I guess is the best way to put it.
Andrea, your family moved into this cool old farmhouse, a big enough home to contain this large family, the Perrin family, and it didn't take long before things started to act up and act very strangely in the house. We've talked with Carmen, we've talked with Chris, both of them not exactly satisfied with the way their story has been portrayed in the media or in the public eye with movies and such. How do you and your family sit with the way your story has been put out there. Obviously, we understand for all of these movies, Hollywood steps in and they have to amp up the volume, if you will, amp up the creep factor to try to make it a saleable commodity to draw people in. But overall, do you feel that you've been treated pretty fairly in the press and in Hollywood?
I feel that we've been treated very fairly in the press for the most part. You know, this was a different situation for me because I was already writing the books but when Hollywood came calling. And to this day, I don't know how they knew what I was doing because I hadn't even told members of my own family that after 30 years, I had decided it was time to tell our story. I gave them complete access to the whole story, even though contractually my trilogy of books, House of Darkness, House of Light, was tied up and pretty secure. I did give them a great deal of information as I was a consultant on the film, and they interviewed every member of our family. It was a unique scenario. I think this is the first time in movie making history where a studio decided to tone down the actual facts of the case rather than to rely on hyperbole and exaggeration. The only thing that I consider that was overtly exaggerated in the film was the exorcism scene. There was no exorcism that ever occurred in our house. There was a seance that Ed and Lorraine Warren foisted upon my parents that went so dreadfully wrong that it almost cost my mother her life. When Hollywood brass at Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema actually learned the whole true story from my books and from our family personally, they thought that it was too intense. And they also felt that it would be literally impossible to compress the 10 years that we lived in the house into a 2-hour film. So essentially what they did was base the film on the case file of Ed and Lorraine Warren, which had its own discrepancies, and compared to the truth, and used the information that I gave them access to. And then they cherry-picked all of that plethora of information and conjured up their own third story by necessity. And I don't fault them for that. My head blew off when I found out that James Wan was going to be the director. In fact, I got so upset with the executive producer that I challenged him, and I said, "You just hired the king of slasher porn to make our intimate family story." And he's like, no, you don't understand. He's really articulate and intelligent and sensitive and masterful filmmaker. And, you know, no, you don't understand. And, you know, when I met James, I really had to retract my statement. And I understand that he treated the girls particularly with tender, loving care and kid gloves. The last thing we wanted was those five children to be traumatized making this movie, because it's not like it would be the first time in history that that had ever happened. You know, the fact is, Dave, and I've told you this personally, my story would be languishing. My books would be languishing in obscurity. The whole true story would be lost amidst thousands of other stories had it not been for The Conjuring. And so essentially I can say I'm grateful to Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema and James Wan and the superb actors who threw themselves wholly, completely into their roles to tell our story to the best of their ability. And they did get it right in the grand scheme of things. They did get it right in the big picture. Good conquers evil, love conquers fear. The Perrin family endured an extreme haunting that they all survived. That's the impression that the audience is left with, and that is the correct impression. And if anybody wants to know more, the fine lines of history were out in the books well before the movie opened. And so if they're going to that film for anything other than entertainment value, if they really actually seek information, it's available. And so I guess I don't really have any resentment of Hollywood around it, and I'm actually grateful to them for the job that they did.
And you can find her trilogy of books, House of Darkness, House of Light, on Amazon.com. Just look up Andrea Perrin. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and start to look behind the stories on these movies and in the real life experiences of these survivors. We'll do that when we return to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. This evening, a look at extreme haunting survivors as we talk with surviving family members from The Haunting in Connecticut, The Conjuring, and the Amityville Horror case. Last night, we talked with Karen Smurl from the Smurl haunting case as well. All cases that have been related through Ed and Lorraine Warren. Ed, we lost, I believe, around 2006, 2007. Lorraine, still around and certainly now even more popular, I think, in the public eye because of the movies The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2, the Enfield Poltergeist case. This is not about bashing them, about their legacy or their place in history, but trying to set the record straight and get an understanding for their actual involvement in the cases. Now, Christopher, in the case of Amityville, this wasn't something that they came into and counseled your family through during the situation. They were more of an investigative team that came in after the fact. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. When exactly after we were gone and out of the house, that they were brought in and involved, and more so to go into the house itself, and they wound up doing that what they called the. A psychic slumber party where there's an investigation with a number of...
Christopher, I'm going to have to stop you real quickly. We've got a horrible connection. You're very muffled and staticky. I'll see if we can have our producers clear up the line or get you on a better connection because I'm having almost an impossible time hearing what's you're saying. Let's talk with Carmen. Carmen, there has been a lot of press and controversy surrounding the Haunting in Connecticut case with Ed and Lorraine Warren. Were they involved in this case from start to finish?
The man, the night that I discovered what was going on in my house and that the house was haunted, I called Lorraine Warren at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they came out the very next afternoon. They also did a seance in my house that went horribly wrong, and we toned down a lot of things that happened in our house from the movie as well because they didn't want the darkness. They wanted more an entertainment factor. But the Warrens come in, and they brought in a team of researchers with cameras and radios and all kinds of equipment. And I was a bit overwhelmed because I was already overwhelmed because my complete belief system had been dumped out on the floor the night before, and I had to rethink life as I knew it as a mother and what I'd done to my son. I'd put him in a mental hospital, as you recall, if you do recall that movie that I was in. But they came in, and they had all these researchers, and they went through, and they spent 9.5 weeks, John Zaffis, the godfather, as I call him, spent 9.5 weeks in my house investigating it and experiencing things along with my family.
Now, you said that they involved themselves in a seance.
Yes.
This seance.
The researchers leave the house.
Right.
And they told me never to speak of it. And they came in and they performed a seance. And they wanted me to channel the entity through myself. But me being a staunch Catholic, didn't channel. So
that seems ridiculously dangerous, right? To ask you to open yourself up to the entity to move through you, to communicate through you, as somebody who is not necessarily a psychic or medium, or certainly were not involved in that at that point in your life. Very, very dangerous. Were you surprised at their requests?
Yes. I was very surprised at it, and I didn't understand it being a Catholic because we're taught never to talk to spirits, never to talk to the spirit, ever, under any circumstance. And for me to channel a demon through myself is giving it permission to take my body for a joyride. Well, Carmen Don't Play takes Carmen's body for a joyride. Carmen says, no, you cannot enter me.
Did they believe it was a demon? Did they believe it was a demon at the time, or did they just think that they were dealing with ghosts?
No. We knew it was a demon from the smells. You were talking during one of your commercials. They talk about the smells of demons. Well, we smelled rotting flesh. That was one of the first things we experienced. There was rotting flesh, and the sounds, and the growls, and the scratches, and just the way I found out what was in that house. Dave, I don't know if you remember. The night my niece knocked on my door, on my bedroom door, she was 18, she'd been out on a date, And I went back into her bedroom, and I saw a disembodied hand go up. It was touching them, her private areas, up under her night skirt. And I scooped her up and ran in and called the Catholic Church, and they told me to say the rosary and call them in the morning. When I went to take the rosary from her, it shattered and strewn across two rooms. So at this point, all of my belief system is turned upside down, and I had to call somebody for help. And I called Lorraine Warren, and they came out the next day. But when they did do the seance, the entity showed me ripping Ed's throat out, and I kept rejecting it, and they kept telling me just what to say. But in my mind, I was saying the Lord's Prayer because I did not want to be channeled. I didn't want to channel the being.
Christopher Lutz back on with us, Christopher Quartino. Just so people understand, trying to show respect for our guest, Christopher was at one point adopted by George Lutz, had done a legal name change. He has gone back since to his birth name, Quartino. So if you hear me vacillating between the two names, you'll understand why we're doing that. But for the sake of the show, since people recognize it as the Lutz family, I'll be referring to him as Christopher Lutz. Chris is back with us now as well. Again, to kind of throw it back to you, the involvement of the Warrens really came after your family left. It had nothing to do with your family's involvement during the time of the haunting. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. We were already out of the house. We were living at my grandma's house. And their involvement began looking into the house itself with it vacant.
And actually, they did come back with a very fascinating find, if I understand this correctly. There's a very famous photograph that has surfaced, but it surfaced long after the case was kind of out there, right? There was a camera that they had set up at the top of the stairs, and it happened to capture a photograph of what appears to be a young boy leaning out of one of the door frames.
That's what's caught in the film, and that was shot on a camera that sat on a tripod on the second floor landing, pointing towards what would have been the younger of the daughters of the DeFeo's, Allison DeFeo's bedroom. That picture was one of roughly 30 that were taken on that camera, all the same angle, all the same frame, and nobody noticed that one particular picture. That's the only one where that image is sticking its head out of that doorway. It was discovered. It was kind of an odd thing. There was a lady that was working for my stepdad, George, as his secretary, going through a number of the photos, preparing what they were calling a photo coffee table book with all the pictures from that investigation. And as she was going through trying to pick out that picture, what picture she was going to use, like I said, there's 30 from that roll, and they were all, pretty much all the same. The lady was, and as she changed that page, and she switched back to the page, and the baby kicked again, and that's when she began to study that photo more thoroughly. And that was, according to my parents, this is the way this was discovered. And so this was probably 3 years, roughly 2 to 3 years after those photos were taken. And so it was odd to see that. And then when George had posed a question to my younger sister, Missy, do you recognize anything here? And the words from my younger sister were, that's the boy I used to play with.
Wow. We have got a great show lined up for you, folks. In the last 2 hours of the show, we'll open up phone lines. If you have questions for our guests regarding their hauntings, their stories, or you have your own haunting going on that you want to share with us and perhaps get insight from these three survivors of extreme hauntings, we'll open up those phone lines. You can be a part of the show. Again, tonight is a night of respect and understanding as these three people have come together and are willing to share their insights, their stories, and behind the scenes of some of the most horrifying paranormal encounters in American history. We're going to continue to chat with our guests throughout the evening, all 4 hours they're here with us. And for 2 hours of that, we will be incorporating you, the audience. I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast.